Hi, guys.
Hey, guys.
Welcome back
to the Flick Chicks podcast.
I'm Allison.
And I'm Jane.
How are you, Jane?
Oh, I'm good. It's, I guess, a nice, in quotes, day today.
Jane's like, unfortunately, the sun is out, so...
I'm sad.
And meanwhile, I'm like, the first day I wanted to do things in months. Look, our house is clean.
I know, my house is clean too. I'm so happy about it.
TJ Maxx today, got some home decor.
Home decor.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Even tried to go out to McDonald's to get myself an icy. When it didn't work out, I wasn't upset. That's how you know. It must be a good day. It must really be a good day, because usually that's... devastating to me.
John Mulaney is hosting SNL tonight. Yes. When we're recording this, and we're having a viewing party.
Yes,
because he's a dream.
Yeah, we like his SNL.
They're so funny. His musical sketches are like to die for.
I know, he's so funny.
He's like one of the true SNL hosts.
Yes,
that I will watch it for.
He's a fucking comedy god.
He is.
Sorry, everyone. I'm trying really hard to ease up on my cursing. I think I've talked about that.
It's a work in progress.
It's gonna slip out at least once or twice. Especially during this episode.
This episode is it's a lot. It's our last film in our female director month.
It is. I'm unbuttoning my cardigan, Jane. I'm sorry. It's really hot. This is acrylic, not very breathable.
It's too sensual for me. I can't handle it.
I'm doing the cardigan as a shirt thing, guys.
So this film, American Psycho, if you couldn't tell from the title of the episode.
We're trying not to build up so much to the title anymore.
we realize
it's stupid.
Dumb. We're doing American Psycho, directed by Mary Harron.
Yes, and written by her, right?
Written by her, co-written by her with, one second. Co-written by Mary Harron and Guinevere Turner, so two women.
All right, two women. And it, of course, is based on a book.
Yes, yes.
From the 80s, but adapted by two women and directed by one of those women.
Yes, it's really, really good. It's a movie that a lot of people are not very aware that it was directed by a woman.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know.
Because it's very much about men.
Men? I didn't know it was directed by a woman. Isn't it fun how, spoiler alert if you are not here for the political talk, but I'm about to get into it. Isn't it funny how women can be so good at directing films about men, but I've never really seen a film about a woman that was directed by a man that was as good?
So true. That was as believable.
I'm trying to think of, like, a film about... females, like, really about females.
Yeah, about the female experience.
Yeah, because this is definitely a male experience kind of movie.
Yes, for sure. And I will get into this, but it's such, like, a portrait of 80s greed culture.
Oh my god, yeah. Like, even, like...
If you notice, he mentions, like, Trump, like, four times.
I noticed, indeed.
Because he was, like, the yuppie king.
Yeah, he, like, idolizes Trump. I'm trying to think of, like, the... I can't think of a single movie directed by, like, I'm sure there are some because so many movies are directed by men.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure there's got to be at least one woman, like, centered film directed by a man that was good.
Yeah.
But I can't really think of one.
Can't really think of one right now.
This is definitely the one I would think of if I thought a woman won about men.
Yeah, it's very good, especially for, like, the population they're, like, following. The, you know, very rich, upper class.
Yeah.
Within the first 5 minutes of the film, it's already, like, very established that they are incredibly rich, wealthy.
Yeah, I mean, the first scene in the restaurant establishes that, like...
Oh, it's only $500.
Fast. Yeah, and you're like, ha! Only for one meal. So this debuted on January 21st, 2000 at the Sundance Film Festival and was released in April of that same year.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was a Sundance film.
It's a Sundance film.
Wow!
It received pretty mixed reviews, although financially it did do well.
Uh-huh.
It did receive pretty mixed reviews. A lot of people said that they did not either understand it or that it was, like, really too, like, I guess cartoonish is a good word.
Too, absurd.
Yes, absurd. Because this movie is, like, a dark satire.
Yeah, and it's absurdist.
Yeah, but it's also a thriller.
Yeah. So it's a very unique breed of film.
It is. It's not a lot of films that ride the line of thriller and absurdist film as well as this does.
I agree.
Because there are parts of this movie that make you laugh, but there's also, like, the general feeling of uneasiness at all times.
And just being like, ugh, creeped out.
Yeah. But it has, of course, probably you guys know this, developed pretty cult following since mm-hmm. then. There was a musical, I believe, in 2015.
Which is just techno music with, like, dialogue over it.
Pretty much. Pretty much the scene of Patrick Bateman in the shower getting ready. Imagine that, but instead of the classical music, it's techno music, which is so stupid. They basically took all the pop music that was done in, like, the scenes where he kills people, and they were like, let's just make that the whole musical. And I was like, but 50% of the movie is classical music.
Yeah, you have to switch back and forth. That's why there's not too much of each type of
certain music. Certain things aren't meant to be adapted. It didn't do well. The musical didn't do well. It is a cult musical, I think, but I don't know anybody that really likes it. It had the guy from Doctor Who with the big forehead in
it. Okay, yeah.
Not David Tennant.
I know who you're talking
about. The other guy.
Yeah.
Matt.
I have no idea, but I know who you're talking
about. Matt. I think his name's Matt. Matt was in it.
Just Matt.
He was Doctor Who or something. Doctor Who, the one that everyone creams their pants over, but he actually isn't that cute. That one.
David Tennant's way cuter.
David Tennant has a charm about him.
He does, even as Barty Crouch Jr. Yeah. Harry Potter.
I can see where the David Tennant stands come from. I don't see where the Matt stands come from.
I know what Stan means now.
So we can use that kind of lingo on the show. If you don't know what it is, I've already read the Urban Dictionary definition for it in another episode. You'll have to look it up yourself.
Go back. And listen to it.
You'll have to look it up yourself, or you'll have to find whatever episode it was that I read it. Probably, like, one episode ago.
I think two. It might have been Jennifer's Body.
Oh, there you go. Maybe without a Patreon?
Yeah.
R.I.P. to you guys, because you should have donated. then maybe you would get the edutainment that we provide on there. All right? That's what we are.
That's what we are.
Okay, so, this is, once again, one of those films. You guys know I do this occasionally. Usually Jane and I try and muddle our way through the plots of films scene by scene, but we don't always do the best. This is another one of those films. I don't want to try and do that.
We're going to loosely follow the Wikipedia entry.
We're going to basically read the Wikipedia entry to you. This takes place in 1987.
In New York.
In New York. A wealthy investment banker named Patrick Bateman, his life revolves around dining at trendy restaurants while keeping up appearances for his fiancée, Evelyn? I believe her name is Evelyn.
Evelyn, played by Reese Witherspoon.
Yes. And his circle of wealthy and shallow associates, most of whom he dislikes. I would go a wage of venture and say all.
All of them. He doesn't like them.
I don't think there's ever one he goes, yeah, I like that person.
Well, I mean, they're basically all carbon copies of each other.
Yeah, basically.
So.
Yeah.
They're all, you know, white, brunette, with glasses.
Is that one guy? Is the guy that's, like, gay.
Yes.
With his stupid haircut. He looks like.
He's ginger. He's like, ugh.
He's the only one that looks different.
And they don't respect him as much.
And they always say, like, oh, that guy's a dope. Even though in the movie it appears that he does really well financially. He is one of the hottest fiancés of the group. And I'm pretty sure he has one of the best business cards.
Yes.
So I don't really know where they're getting. Oh, crack it open. Do it in the mic. Whoa, hear that sound.
Red Bull.
Not sponsored.
Red Bull, not sponsored, but we have to stay awake for John Mulaney tonight.
If you want to sponsor us, I'll start drinking Red Bull.
I like it.
Well, there you go. One half of us is already a fan of Red Bull. Okay. Bateman describes the material accoutrements of his lifestyle, including his morning exercise, beautification routine, designer wardrobe, and expensive furniture. That's a great scene.
When I wake up in the morning, I put an ice pack on my eyes if my eyes are a little puffy.
It's really good.
It's really good. It's like Christian Bale doing his voiceover of as he's like doing
getting ready.
And then there's the scene where he does like the chemical peel.
Yeah.
And he like is talking about his metaphorical mask and then he's like tearing off his chemical peel mask.
It's so gross. It looks like a little layer of his skin.
He's like, I'm simply am not there.
Mm-hmm.
So good.
I wish that my skin looked as good as his does in this movie. His skin is beautiful. I guess
Christian Bale did the same beauty routine during the filming of this film.
So is that the beauty routine I need to be doing?
Apparently the one from American Psycho.
I just need to be super rich.
Do it for the bit.
YouTube video. Oh my god, I'm starting a beauty YouTube. And the YouTube is, I do the American Psycho beauty routine for a whole month. Not clickbait.
Not clickbait.
And here's what it is. It's, yeah, it works, but you're going to need about $1,200 every 3 months to splurge on beauty products. I may have to get sponsored before I can do that video.
Yeah.
If anyone would like to sponsor that video, I will do it.
Christian Bale?
Christian Bale? I could make you relevant.
You just did Ford versus Ferrari. What do you think you are?
Oh my god, yeah, don't talk about Ford versus Ferrari. The movie that nobody saw but somehow won some Oscars. I was like, Ford, what's that?
What's that?
I've never heard of that. And everyone in the theater was like, everyone was like cheering when certain things won, and then it was like Ford versus Ferrari, and like nobody said. Everyone was like, what? Who? What's Ford versus Ferrari? A movie about cars? No movies about cars needed to be made after Cars 3.
So true.
And that was the bet. That was peak car. We can't get any better.
Thank you, Owen Wilson, for your service.
Thank you. I mean, before that, we had some good car movies, we have to admit. I mean, there was Herbie's, what was it, Herbie's Limit?
With Lindsay Lohan.
Yeah. Herbie?
Herbie Fully Loaded.
Herbie Fully Loaded, not Herbie's Limit.
Just so that's the sequel where he has a midlife crisis and he reaches his limit.
We should make that. No, I just said what I said. There's no more car movies. Not in my mind. He also discusses his music collection in scholarly detail. He does. He speaks like he's constantly reading an essay.
Well, he's doing a thesis. He's presenting a thesis at all times.
Bateman and his associates flaunt their business cards in a display of vanity. Enraged by the superiority of his coworker Paul Allen's card, Bateman murders a homeless man and his dog.
Paul Allen's played by Jared Leto.
Yeah, I find that such a funny sentence. At a Christmas party, Bateman makes plans to have dinner with Allen, who mistakes Bateman for another coworker. This is a constant
thing.
This
happens a lot because they all look the same.
They all look exactly the same. And honestly, at some points, you kind of get confused.
Yes.
Bateman gets Allen drunk and lures him back to his apartment while playing Hip to Be Square.
It's Hip to Be Square. I just keep thinking about the Roger from American Dad bit where he does that.
That's Huey Lewis in the News, I believe. Mm-hmm. Bateman delivers a monologue to Allen about the artistic merits of the song and then murders Allen with a chrome axe. There's a great scene where he's like, this whole scene, honestly, I'm just going to constantly say this word. What a great scene.
There are so many good scenes.
So many iconic scenes, too. Like, scenes that you've seen referenced so much in pop culture. And until you see this movie, you're like, so that's where that comes from.
Yeah, it's like the Hip to Be Square thing. So many, shows have done that.
Yeah, it's like, he has all this newspaper laying out, and there's, like, tarps on his furniture. It's just ridiculous. He's
wearing a raincoat.
And he goes and puts on a raincoat and, like, gloves. And he comes out and then...
Just murders him and he gets blood all over his face and his teeth.
It's, oh my god, the teeth blood is the worst part.
He does that all the time.
It's so gross. Okay. I guess that is something that would happen, but also, he then disposes of the body and then stages Alan's apartment so that others believe Allen has gone to London. Bateman is later interviewed about Allen's disappearance by private detective Donald Kimball.
Willem Dafoe. I love him.
Yeah, and Willem Dafoe, this is kind of, I think when Detective Kimball comes in is when you first start to see, like,
how many holes are in Patrick Bateman's personality.
Yeah, because you see it, and you think, wow, this guy's unhinged.
But you don't see it as much when he's around his colleagues, because they're all American psychos.
They're all the same.
And then you come in, and you see Willem Dafoe's character, and who is, like, a normal person. Mm-hmm. And you just see the stark difference between them.
Well, it was interesting. We were talking about sociopaths and how they act. And I guess in this case, Bateman's pretty much psychopath, but...
They're actually interchangeable, those two words.
Really? Mm-hmm. I always just sociopath as, like, non-violent and psychopath as, like, turned violent.
See, it's really... There's, like, a lot of... it's very convoluted, but they're actually interchangeable.
All right. Well, he's a psychopath.
Yeah, he's a psychopath. And so he's very narcissistic. Yeah. He literally cannot feel things. He can't understand other people, and he doesn't, you know, understand social cues a lot because he has to read people.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about this film is the reason you never know. This is what I think is such a good thing about this film that people never talk about with Bateman, or like with Christian Bale's performance. People talk a lot about how he's very convincing and good, but he is so convincing as a psychopath who's like charming.
Yes.
Because he, like, when you watch him with other people, I mean, you know he's crazy because you can hear his inner monologue, right? Yes. But when you watch him with other people, occasionally he gets upset, but in my opinion, that's just sort of a rich person thing.
Yeah.
So it's easy to understand.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like it's when he meets Detective Kimball, and Kimball is not giving him anything.
No.
He's perfectly neutral. He's pleasant neutral. And, like, because even, like, he does, Bateman does interact with some people who are more normal. Like, his secretary, Jean.
Yeah.
He interacts with her, and he treats her like, you can tell he reads off her energy a lot.
Yeah.
And anyone he interacts with that's not rich, he reads off their energy a lot. But he can't read Kimball's energy or his, like, emotions or his feelings. So he's just floundering.
He's just flat.
Because he's trying to figure out what the right thing to say is, and he can't figure it out because Detective Kimball won't give him anything.
Yeah. Because he's a detective and he has to be guarded like that.
But he's a good detective.
He's a good detective.
And
yeah.
It's like, you can just tell how much Patrick Bateman is freaking out. Also, he's so good at the dead behind the eyes.
Behind the eyes, he's so good.
At
like,
it.
You just don't see anything.
Nothing.
It's like pictures of Ted Bundy whenever he has that face, and you're just like, wow.
There's nothing.
There's nothing there.
I know. So freaky.
He does it so well.
I know. Okay. So Bateman takes two prostitutes, who he names Christy and Sabrina.
This is so upsetting.
It's so sad. To his apartment, and expounds on his opinions of the band Genesis. After they have sex, which, by the way, he records.
He records, and he, like, looks at himself in the mirror instead of the girls. Because classic psychopath move.
Yeah. But then after they have sex, they're like, oh, can we go home? And he goes, we're not done. And he brings out this...
Wire hanger.
He brings out instruments that he uses for bodily harm, which is a wire hanger, but it's in, like, a drawer of other sadistic instruments.
Yes.
And
then it cuts to them leaving.
And they later leave his apartment, evidently bloodied and mistreated.
Yes.
So then, Bateman's colleague, Lewis Carruthers, this is the bozo, reveals a new business card. Bateman tries to kill Lewis in the restroom of an expensive restaurant, but Lewis mistakes the attempt for a sexual advance and declares his love for Bateman, who flees in disgust. I also like how Lewis is the only person who knows who Patrick Bateman is the whole movie.
Yes, me too. And I really like how he washes his gloves.
Yes!
It's like so absurdist.
It is so absurd. He's like, call me.
Yeah.
Who's that actor? He's in a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, he is.
He's always like a comedy character, so it's kind of funny to see him in something like this. Which, I mean, I guess he still is the comedic relief, but... comedic relief of this movie.
Lewis Carruthers. Played by Matt Ross.
Okay. Don't know that name.
He was in Captain Fantastic. I love that. Silicon Valley. The Aviator. Good Night and Good Luck. That's about it.
I feel like I've seen his face a lot.
I'm trying to see. He's in a lot of TV shows.
That's probably what it is. So, who flees in disgust. After murdering a model, Bateman invites his secretary Jean to dinner, suggesting she meet him at his apartment for drinks. When Jean arrives, unbeknownst to her, Bateman holds a nail gun to the back of her head while they chat. When he receives a message from Evelyn, I'm sorry, I was in a play once where it was spelled this way and his name was Evelyn.
Yes.
Evelyn, on his answering machine, he asks Jean to leave. So, that's an interesting scene, too, because I think it's misleading a bit.
Yeah.
In the way that it kind of makes you think, like, oh, maybe Patrick has feelings, like, he feels bad for Jean. But But I don't think that's what it is.
But I don't think it's what it is. Okay, so everything that psychopaths do are in their is in their own self-interest.
Yeah.
And so if he murders his secretary, he's going to be one of the first people they look at.
Yeah, so I think it's just a moment for him to be like, oh, shit.
I don't want to do this because this is going to get me in trouble.
In trouble. Not because he cares about Jean, but because he doesn't want to get in trouble. It's just misleading because the conversation they're having is about her future. But keep in mind, it's not her conversation about her future that stops Jean.
Yeah.
It's Evelyn calling and snapping him back to reality that, like, other people exist.
Yep.
Kimball meets Bateman for lunch and tells him he is not under suspicion in Alan's disappearance. Basically because he tells him that the night that he was supposed to be out murdering Paul Allen, he was supposedly at dinner with another group of people.
Mm-hmm.
So, who have all named him. Now, we'll have to talk about this later.
Yes.
But this is a large part of where people mistaking people for other people might come in play.
Yes.
If you're doing a theory test.
Definitely.
But he basically says, there's no way you murdered Alan because you were at dinner with these people. And they all vouched for you. And he was like, totally. I just forgot.
Yeah.
Bateman invites Christy, so the prostitute from before.
Mm-hmm.
And his
sex worker.
Yes. Sorry. The sex worker. And his acquaintance Elizabeth to Alan's apartment for sex. And then he kills Elizabeth during the act. Elizabeth is just his friend or something. Christy runs, discovering multiple female corpses as she searches for an exit.
That's such a good scene.
Yeah. A naked Bateman chases her and drops a chainsaw on her. She flees down the staircase, killing her.
Okay, so that scene is, it's a lot, but I love whenever he's, you see that true psychosis whenever he's at the top of the stairs mm-hmm. and he's screaming with, like, the blood all over his face.
So scary. Okay. Bateman breaks off his engagement with Evelyn. I was almost right the first time. That night, he uses an ATM. He sees a cat. Also, I want to say one of my favorite lines in the movie is when he's talking to Evelyn after he broke up with her, and he just goes, "You're just not terribly important to me." I was like, whoa, hurts. That night, he uses an ATM. He sees a cat, and the ATM displays the text, "Feed me a stray cat." He then prepares to shoot the cat, but a woman confronts him, so he shoots her.
Yeah.
A police chase ensues, but Bateman kills all four cops with his one pistol.
Yeah,
this is where things start to go
very absurdist.
Crazy.
But it's very much like the amount of drama that follows him on, like, his perceived drama is mm-hmm. very much due to his ego and like, self-importance.
He thinks, I just killed four cops with one pistol.
Like, I am so self-important that they're, like, a manhunt for mm-hmm. me or whatever.
Mm-hmm. But it is kind of interesting because there is a moment after he kills all four of the cops with his one pistol and he's not hit even once by a bullet.
Mm-hmm.
He looks down the gun and he goes, like, what?
Yeah.
He, like, can't even believe it himself. It's so ridiculous. So, fleeing to his office, Bateman enters the wrong building, where he murders a security guard and a janitor. It's interesting because when he runs into he runs in this building. The security guard says, "Mr. Smith," not his name. He shoots the security guard.
Yeah.
He shoots a janitor just to kill the witness. And then runs into an identical building across the street, which is his building.
Very much like people mistaking each other for the same person. And mistaking the building, because everything is just the same,
exactly the same
in this world.
Pierce and Pierce. So he runs into Pierce and Pierce. And it is in an office he believes is his, Bateman calls his lawyer Harold Carnes, and frantically leaves a confession regarding the many murders on Carnes' answering machine. He says, like, this very surreal scene, because he's drenched in sweat.
Mm-hmm.
He's, like, crying, but he's also, like, laughing.
Yeah.
And he's...
It's kind of ridiculous.
It's really weird, too, because one of, like, the distinguishing characteristics of Patrick Bateman is this voice he has,
mm-hmm.
which Christian Bale's just so good at. It's this, like...
Very, like melodic?
Yeah,
is that the word?
Yeah. It's, like, deep and soothing, but it's also so creepy because it just has, like, little to no
emotion behind it.
But yeah. It's pleasant.
Yes.
But it's also, like, just emotionless.
Yes.
And in this scene, he has, like, a lisp. His voice is completely not at all like it's been for the whole movie.
Which, you know, maybe couldn't... The break in his character. Yeah, the exactly. break in that facade.
Yeah, and it's very interesting. Bateman then meets again with Detective Kimball, who remains suspicious of him but can't prove that Alan was murdered, as Alan was spotted in London after the alleged murder took place. But the witness was unsure at first. Kimball tells Bateman that it's possible Alan actually just went on vacation without informing anyone, leaving Bateman visibly disturbed. So he's like, he's thinking somebody must have just seen the wrong guy.
But yeah, it's okay because I murdered him.
But it's okay because now I'm off
yeah.
the radar, right? So the following morning, Bateman visits Alan's apartment, expecting to clean up Alan's remains, but it is vacant and for sale. He pretends to be a potential buyer, but the realtor tricks Bateman into revealing that he isn't there to buy the apartment. She then cryptically tells him that this isn't Paul Allen's apartment, before ordering him to leave. She kind of, like, acts like she doesn't know who Paul Allen is at all.
Yeah.
But she never comes out and straight up says, I don't know who Paul Allen is. She kind of, like, weirdly is like, this apartment doesn't belong to a Paul Allen.
Mm-hmm.
And it, like, is really weird. Like, it makes you feel like she might be lying.
Yeah.
But it also makes you feel like she might just be weirded out by this guy and she really doesn't know who Paul Allen is.
And maybe that's just how he perceives her because he's just he's unreliable right. narrator.
Exactly. And it's definitely from his point of view. And it also could be, like, she isn't telling him because he's not there to view it. Like, I don't really know what the rules are on that in realtor world. Yeah. I'm not a realtor. But it leaves Bateman visibly disturbed. Oh, wait. Nope. He leaves. But that does disturb him also. When Bateman goes to meet with his colleagues for lunch, a horrified Jean finds detailed drawings of murder and mutilation in Bateman's office journal. So these are, like, basically drawings of everything we've seen.
Of him do. Plus more. Yeah.
Which, when we see the closet scene where Christy is running away,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there's tons of women in there that we have never seen.
Yeah, that we have no idea that he killed her or anything.
Yeah. Bateman sees Carnes at the restaurant and mentions the phone message he left the prior evening. Carnes mistakes Bateman for another colleague and laughs off the phone confession as a joke. Bateman desperately explains who he is and again confesses to the murders, but Carnes says that's impossible as he recently had dinner with Alan in London. And he says, like, 2 days ago. As a confused and exhausted Bateman returns to his friends, where they briefly muse on whether Ronald Reagan is a harmless old man or a hidden psychopath, before discussing their dinner reservations yet again. Left with the possibility that no one knows he's a murderer, or that he simply hallucinated the various killings, Bateman's voiceover narration reveals his realization that he will escape the punishment he desires, and that there has been no catharsis, saying, this confession has meant nothing.
Yeah. It's, apparently it's more ambiguous in the book.
Yeah. Yes. It is, I think she said it, I read this, like, interview that I'll read later, it's pretty long, but, where basically she said, like, the book has more of an open ending, mm-hmm. but she thinks it leaves less questions than the movie does.
Gotcha.
And she said that's actually something she wishes she could change, so she wishes she could go back.
Yeah.
And make the movie a tad bit less ambiguous because she thinks it's kind of muddled the point of the movie a bit.
Yeah, it's kind of like Fight Club a little bit. Like, ooh, what does it mean though?
And it's like it doesn't mean anything beyond what it meant.
Yeah, and I think this film really at its core is about the 1980s greed culture.
I think so,
and
too.
Like excess and how you lose, like, your identity.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is these, like, Wall Street people, just how crazy they are.
Yeah.
Because, and something that's really interesting about this film is these people seem so ridiculous. The stuff they talk about seems so petty and stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And they just have these exorbitant amounts of wealth. But then, like, that's kind of how really rich people like that are.
Jordan,
like,
Belfort exists.
Yeah. And a lot of people who I know who have met, like, incredibly wealthy people, like, I mean, not like Jeff Bezos wealthy,
mm-hmm.
but I imagine this applies to him if it applies to, like, multimillionaires,
mm-hmm.
which is that they talk like this. They literally act like this. Like, this is really what they think about. And then at the same time, they think, like, poor people don't have problems. It's so funny. They're like, oh, poor people. And you're like, you're literally mad about a business card.
Yeah.
That looks exactly the same as yours.
The off-white texture.
Oh, it's so funny. It's perfect. It's better than mine. So silly, but it's like...
It's scary, but silly.
It's scary, but silly, because what's kind of scary about it is that it's sort of true.
Yeah.
That's what's scary about it.
Yeah, because, like, people... I know a guy who, like, is a psychopath, and, like, people like this exist.
This is really what they think about. And, like, they really don't see the problem.
Yeah.
I know that's something that... I remember when I was in psychology or whatever, we were talking about psychopaths and sociopaths, and it was not a big part of our lecture at all. It was very small. But we were talking about, how you classify mental disorders, and we talked about that, and she was like, it's kind of hard because... It's not really damaging, which is, like, one of the qualifications to be considered, like, a mental disorder, is it has to, like, cause harm.
Yeah, cause distress, harm or personal distress.
And it doesn't cause them personal distress, and a lot of times it doesn't cause harm to anyone either.
Yeah, exactly.
She was like, not that it can't cause harm.
Yeah.
She was like, but perfectly mentally well people cause harm as well. She's like, so it's kind of weird that people don't really know where to put it.
Yeah.
And there's not really anything you can do about it.
Yeah, people are, like, there's just been so much controversy over the antisocial personality disorder diagnosis itself.
Yeah.
And, like, right now, it's basically categorical, so, like, if you have antisocial personality disorder, you're grouped into the same category as, like, psychopaths, but I think, and, like, in the future, the DSM is going to maybe change this, making it, like, a spectrum more like, so, like, someone might have more severe symptoms than someone else.
Right. You could be, like, Patrick Bateman, but you could also not be.
Exactly.
So this is a really interesting... Obviously, because this movie is so ambiguous, a lot of people want to know what is the truth, right? Like, what... Did he kill the people? Did he not? Like, what is it? So I have my theory.
Okay.
I don't know what your theory is.
Okay.
What do you think?
I want to hear yours first.
Okay. So, I'll read... I have an article that lists a bunch of different theories, but my theory is that he committed some of those murders, but he did not kill Paul Allen. That Paul Allen was indeed a hallucination, but that he did murder multiple other people because he thought he murdered Paul Allen. Now, he maybe didn't murder all the people he thought he did.
Yeah.
But I think he murdered the homeless guy. I think it's likely that he murdered the model... I don't think he murdered
I don't think he murdered sex worker. I don't think he did.
I don't think he murdered Elizabeth.
No.
I think a lot of the murders we see are fake. I think if a murder seems super impractical, it's probably not real.
Yeah.
I think he might have shot that lady at the ATM.
Yeah.
But I don't think there was a police chase at all. I don't think anyone saw it.
I don't think so either.
I don't think he shot the security guard or the janitor. I think some of the murders happened, but not all of them.
Do you think it would be possible for if he... But what if he did kill Paul Allen and the entire thing, like, in England or whatever, is just them mistaking identities again?
I think that's possible. I think it's possible.
Okay.
But I feel like... Nobody ever mistakes Paul Allen's identity in the film.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't notice that.
A lot of... I don't think anyone ever accidentally thinks someone is Paul Allen.
Okay.
So, for one, I think Paul Allen is a lot cooler than Patrick Bateman. They constantly talk about whenever they don't know who... Whenever they don't realize they're talking to Patrick Bateman, they talk about what a loser Patrick Bateman is.
Yeah.
So, I think that perhaps he's a loser. I mean, he's not a loser, obviously. But I think he is a loser.
In that social circle,
I think he's barely above Carruthers.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, that is something that he struggles to come to terms with. So he constantly thinks that there's, like, this mistaken identity, but it's only really him.
Yeah.
And, like, one other person who people constantly mistake him for. Okay. So I'm going to read some of these
Okay.
things. So This is an article from cinemablend.com. They have the same opinion as me.
Okay.
So let's see. I'm trying to find where they actually start the theory and where they're not just talking about the plot, because we already did that. Okay. Sorry, it's so long. I have to talk about all this stuff. Okay. So there's a little question here that Patrick Bateman is an absolute lunatic. But the big question at the end of American Psycho is whether he is a serial killer or just a sadist with extreme delusions and a vivid imagination. It is our stance that Bateman does actually murder many people over the course of the movie, but there is one exception. He did not actually kill Paul Allen. Really, this conclusion could be drawn by just taking all of the evidence the film presents at face value. There's not only Harold's claim about having seen Paul Allen in London and the murder-free apartment, but there is also the investigation headed up by Detective Donald Kimball. For a good portion of the movie, it looks like Bateman is just on the verge of getting caught for Allen's murder, but then Kimball drops the case after finding the protagonist has an alibi. How did this happen? Because Bateman never killed Allen and instead just imagined the whole thing. It's firmly established throughout the film that American Psycho's lead character has an obsession and extreme hatred of Paul Allen, but it's the passion that could easily be explained how everything involving Allen's murder just played out in Bateman's head. What we see play out with the newspaper, the raincoat, the axe, is merely an extremely vivid false reality. It makes sense that Bateman could have heard about Allen taking a trip up to London and incorporated it into the fantasy via the outgoing answer machine message that he leaves. Admittedly, there's also some ambiguity to the other deaths as well, and while I do believe that he killed a good number of people, such as the homeless man, and this person thinks they killed the sex workers. I don't agree.
I disagree.
I don't think that chainsaw. I don't think that chainsaw. The chain.
And also, no one heard that chainsaw.
Yeah, and how did he clean it up? There's no cameras. Also, she was literally screaming through the halls, and he was naked.
Yeah, I don't think.
I don't think it happened at all. Also, you'd have to be a pretty good shot.
True.
It's interesting to note that the movie also provides viewer with a good deal of doubt regarding the extent of Bateman's crimes. The reason why the third act is so key to understanding the ending of American Psycho is because it establishes that we are seeing the world through the protagonist's eyes and nothing can be trusted. An ATM does not actually flash the message, "Feed me a stray cat." And Bateman's run from the cops is certainly heightened to the point where you begin to question even the smallest details of reality. Again, this is just a psychotic imagination flaring up. The extent to which this idea can be applied to the rest of the film is up to the viewer, but it can swing both ways. Ultimately, the brilliance in American Psycho's ending isn't the question whether Patrick Bateman killed zero people, just a few homeless individuals, or everyone he lists in the answering machine. The more significant take is meant to be present in the satire that comes in Bateman admitting his horrific crimes and nobody taking him seriously. He not only lives an entirely shallow existence where the inside doesn't matter, but he has been driven to the point where he has become a mystery even unto himself, and only really knows that he wants to inflict inner pain on others. Tragic as it is to say, the number of people he may or may not have killed is inconsequential, just like the film's existence as Bateman's confession. So then here are some alternate theories. One interpretation of American Psycho's finale is far from the only opinion floating out there, but this is where you can probably piece together what the alternate theory is. Bateman actually killed everybody, including Paul Allen. In order to believe this, you have to go with the flow when it comes to the aforementioned fantasy and delusion featured in the movie's third act. But there is an argument to be made. The key is in the film's deep, deep satire. As demonstrated by the fact that Bateman, is constantly misrecognized by other characters throughout the film, the protagonist of American Psycho is painted as little more than a face in the yuppie-filled crowd. His intense desperation to fit in actually has rendered him invisible, with his job as Valentino Suits and Oliver People's glasses serving as his camouflage. He's so invisible that he can go on a murderous rampage through downtown New York and walk away without anybody noticing. And again, his high status prevents anyone from believing his outrageous story of death and mayhem. In regards to the murder of Paul Allen, the exact same satire explanation can also explain why Bateman's encounter with his lawyer in the final scene. Allen is presented through the film as being a bigger deal than the protagonist, but it's not out of the question that he is also perceived by others to just be another Bateman ilk who can easily be confused with someone else. It's a stretch, which is why it's not our primary theory, but maybe Harold had just had dinner in London with someone he thought was Paul Allen. while the real Paul dissolved in the bathtub. Where this theory really loses its wheel, however, is when you consider the status of Paul Allen's apartment at the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Some argue that the place looks so sterile, it's possible Bateman unknowingly did the cleanup himself. But that doesn't really explain the presence of the realtor and her apparent unawareness of who Paul Allen is.
Mm-hmm.
This really goes a long way in crippling that theory. Here's another theory that I read on Reddit, which talks about that problem with the realtor. And they say the problem could be explained because perhaps the realtor covered it up.
Yeah.
They basically said it's possible that they didn't know who left all those bodies in the apartment.
Uh-huh.
All they know is that the apartment is rich, they can't find Paul Allen at all, and that they need to cover it up. They could have found Allen's dead body. It could have just been like, oh, we don't know who did it, but they killed a lot of people in here, including Paul Allen. So what we need to do is cover it up and sell the apartment as fast as possible so we can get money.
Mm-hmm.
Which just seems like a bit of a stretch to
me. Seems like a bit of a stretch.
Seems like a bit of a stretch, but the movie is really kind of ridiculous. So I guess it's possible if you're going to just say that the only thing that makes me really not think that is that then what's the point of all the delusions at the end?
Yeah.
Because no one can argue that an ATM actually flashed "Feed me a stray cat."
Yeah. Very true.
So if you want to know what the filmmakers have to say,
I think I watched an interview with her.
Mary.
Yeah.
And Guinevere. They say that Patrick Bateman is most definitely a serial killer.
Okay.
They said, for sure, he actually did really kill people. Some people think he didn't, that all of it's a delusion.
Uh-huh. But they're like, no.
But they say, no, that's not true. Like, so I don't think that either. I don't think the idea that Patrick Bateman never killed anybody.
I definitely think he at least killed, like, some of them.
Yeah, I definitely think he killed some homeless people. She explained, I'm gonna move on. I already talked about how she said she made the thing too open-ended. She said, what starts to happen as the movie progresses, that you're seeing what's going on in his head. So when he shoots a car and it explodes, even he for a second is like, huh? Because even he is starting to believe that his perception of reality cannot be right.
Mm-hmm.
As he goes more crazy, what you actually see becomes more distorted and harder to figure out. But it's meant to be that he really is killing all these people. It's just that he's probably not as nicely dressed. It probably didn't go as smoothly as he's perceiving it to go. The sex workers probably weren't as hot, etc., etc. It's just Bateman's fantasy world.
Interesting.
So,
just unreliable narrator.
Yeah, that still 100%. Doesn't tell us if Paul Allen was really killed or not.
Yeah.
But it does tell us that he probably did kill someone. Which means that probably brings it to at least one of those two theories.
Yeah, I agree.
What do you think?
I think that he probably didn't kill Paul Allen, and most definitely didn't kill the sex worker.
Mm-hmm.
He might have killed the model. I believe he killed the homeless man.
Yeah.
I
mean, I guess it is. If you go again, I think there is like a third theory, sort of, which is that he did do all the murders, but that none of the actual murders happened the way we see them. So it's possible he did kill the sex workers, but it is not possible that he dropped a chainsaw on her.
Very true.
Down a spiral staircase.
Yes.
And that it sawed her in half.
Yeah, that is not what happened.
That definitely didn't happen. But it is possible that maybe he beat her to death or something.
Yeah.
It's probably not likely that Paul Allen came into his apartment drunk and didn't at all think anything about the fact that there was newspapers and tarp all over the floor. Yeah. He probably didn't put on a raincoat. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Also, isn't it at the beginning of the film, he comes in with the bed sheets, right, that are stained?
Yeah.
Nobody talks about that, but that means he's probably murdered before.
Exactly.
Or he was sadistically beating people.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he clearly
has all these torture devices
already.
Yeah.
I mean, at one point, he opens a closet that's just full of duct tape and, like, when Jean's over.
Yeah.
So freaky.
Freaky. Do you have an IMDb review for me?
I do. Do you know of any other theories?
I do not know of any other theories.
These are some very weird. There were some very weird reviews for this film. This film is not as highly rated as I think it should be.
I have been looking into that, and I definitely don't think that it's as high as rated as it should be.
Okay. I have three of them that I love, but I'm going to read two of them. One of them is very short.
Okay.
One of them is medium length. The other one was basically just talking about how there was no hero or villain in this movie, and how that doesn't make for a good plot, and I was like, this is not the only movie of all time that doesn't have a direct hero and villain.
Annoying.
I know. I was like, I don't want to waste time on this. Okay. This one's funny because it is so incredibly poorly written that it looks like it was written by a child. 1 out of 10. The killer poos. I don't know. Ooh. I don't know. Here we go. This movie is awful. It is badly written and has an awful ending. It is not scary. I keep hearing it is comedy. Where is the Hummer? Clearly meant to be humor. I have seen comedies where were, by the way, I want to read this as it is, but I'm trying to correct it, but it is spelled wrong, where I can tell there are play something for laughs, and I just did not think it was funny. But do not see this movie as bad comedy. I do no see it as being comedy at all. Serial killer is one a spear. I don't know. This movie is not good for people who want to get scared. It is for people who like to laugh ever. It is for people who like badly made horror movie, not a comedy. It is for people who like to see lots of fake blood. Good actors wasted their talent being in this awful movie. Do not waste your time. And do not waste your money. Do not see this movie. It is one of the worst horror movies ever.
Do not waste your time.
Do not waste your time. W-A-S-T. Okay. 1 out of 10. Very disappointing. The scariest part of the film is the close-up of Phil Collins' CD cover. This had the potential to be brilliant, but it is very poorly written. The dialogue is weak, to say the least. The main character's dialogue is inane and pretentious, and the feeble attempt to add depth by petty obsessiveness does not work to the judging eye. I don't think he's supposed to be deep.
I don't think he's supposed to be deep at all.
In fact, I've quite literally never seen a review of this where they didn't call all the characters shallow. Okay. Also, he is remarkably insecure, which is greatly at odds with his achievements in life. A brilliant, calculating career man, which is what he must have been up to this point in his life to get the office that he has. First of all, his father owns the company.
Yeah.
Which is mentioned. Kind of funny that nobody cares at all that his dad owns the company, but it is mentioned, mm-hmm. like, twice. And yeah, he is insecure.
Yeah. He wants to be better than everyone else.
Yeah.
But he's not.
Yeah, when you're obsessed with power, I don't know if I'd call that, I don't know if I'd say he's insecure, because he has a huge ego,
mm-hmm.
but he wants to be the best at everything, always.
Mm-hmm.
In the parts where Bale is about to wreak havoc, he embarks on postmodern soliloquy based on the careers of pop stars. No doubt the aim of these commentaries was to chill our spines. That this highly reasoning exponent of individualism could use his intelligence to mindly chop people up.
Exponent of individualism?
I know.
That's not what it's about. I know. That's exactly the opposite of what it's about.
I was like, this person did not get that Patrick Bateman was crazy. He thought Patrick Bateman was a normal guy who just happened to kill people for some reason.
Patrick Bateman did nothing wrong.
Patrick Bateman... This highly intelligent man chops people up? Yeah, he's not totally psycho from the minute you first see him. Listen, the voiceover in a calming way describing yourself is the number one most... It's how I identify when people are going to be crazy and things immediately. I listen to a lot of audio horrors,
mm-hmm.
and... It's become impossible for me to not realize immediately when it's a stalker and or serial killer story mm-hmm. told from their point of view because they always sound like this.
Yeah, definitely.
Patrick Bateman is the template.
Yes.
However, rather than being spine-tingling, the dialogue merely bores us to death, and the victim surely would have not felt any pain. And they would have been rendered unconscious by his mind-numbing long before he got around to dismembering them.
Ugh.
He's just shouting stuff to hear himself talk, mainly.
Yeah, that's what...
I don't really think he cares about the music at all.
No, he just wants to show off how much he knows.
Yeah, before he kills them. He wants to show off how smart he is before he physically overpowers
and
them.
He's probably like, oh, normal people like music. That's what they want to hear about.
Huey's too black sounding for me.
Ugh.
Blech. And then he's like, well, teach their own, I guess. Where the hell was the end? Perhaps they realized it was going to be as pants as the rest of the movie and cut it. As pants.
As pants.
As pants as the rest of the movie. Pants is bad, I guess. The scariest part of the film is the close-up of the Phil Collins CD cover. Sorry, Christian, this film couldn't cut mustard, let alone its victims.
Oh my god. What does couldn't cut mustard mean?
I don't know, there's so many weird expressions in there, huh? So many weird things that nobody says.
I wonder how old that person is.
It felt like a bot. It's so weird. So weird. Also... okay, this first one, I just want to say, they compare this movie to The Great Gatsby by saying it's a pointless body of motion picture. I was like, you didn't like The Great Gatsby? I mean, I don't necessarily love the movie, and The Great Gatsby isn't, like, the top piece of film for me, but I understand The Great Gatsby is making social commentary.
Yeah. What would you give this film?
I give it a 9 out of 10.
I would, too. It's a great movie. I like it a lot. Christian Bale is awesome.
Yes, he is. He does so good. So good.
I sent Allison, like, this video of all the things that, like, all the weight thing that he, like, goes between Ooh. Being really skinny and being yeah. really heavy in movies, and it's, like, really upsetting.
I know. It's hard. He's one of those actors.
Yeah.
I kind of always forget about Christian Bale, honestly.
Is he, like, a Bradley Cooper for you?
Yeah. But not as much. Bradley Cooper, I quite literally forget he's an actor. I always think Bradley Cooper is like a country star.
That's really funny.
And then I'm like, no, he's an actor. And that's like his primary gig.
That's what he does.
He does not. He doesn't
he's like an Oscar nominated actor.
He doesn't do something else. He never did something else and then became an actor. He's not like Dolly Parton. Bradley Cooper has always been an actor. But I could not wrap my head around that.
That's fascinating.
I think Bradley Cooper is like Tim McGraw or something, but if Tim McGraw became an actor.
He's not even country. He just played American Sniper that one time.
That's why, I think.
I mean, he was good, but like also people like...
I didn't see American Sniper.
It's a war movie, and
that's
so
why
it,
I didn't
it
see
lies
it.
About, you know, how America's the hero and about how
Always.
All soldiers are heroes. You know, whatever, it's fine.
We don't watch war movies. I didn't watch... I literally... 1917 looked good, but I was like, no.
It's a war
movie. I'm not
going
to watch it.
I'm not going to watch it.
I
unless
don't
it's
watch an, war movies.
Unless it's Tarantino, because it's not actually a war movie. Like, Inglourious Basterds doesn't feel like a war movie.
It's not about the war. Also, okay, World War II movies are a bit more interesting, which I guess 1917 is a World War I movie.
Yeah.
A bit more interesting because I do actually think we were in the right on that one.
Yeah.
But past World War II, I'm really not interested.
So true. Vietnam movies?
Specifically, Iraq.
Oh my god.
And Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Really not interested in seeing movies about that.
Agreed. It's not in... okay, guys, I don't know if you know this, but so...
this is interesting.
This is really interesting.
Edutainment!
Edutainment! Okay, so... the reason war movies have all those, like, artillery and stuff is because they make a deal with the American government to use mm-hmm. those, like, whatever... Tanks and guns and helicopters.
Uniforms.
They make an agreement with the U.S. government to use all those things if the U.S. government can have final say of what goes into the film. So nothing that makes America look bad can go into the film.
Yeah, basically that's why there is no... and, like, here's the thing. I was wondering one time, I was like, why are there no war films criticizing war? Like, criticizing, like, the Vietnam War or the Korean War or
yeah.
the Iraq-Afghani War... why are there none of those when those are, like, some of the most criticized war in American history?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why are there no movies criticizing that? It's because the government
controls war them. Movies.
Controls war movies and will only allow positive films about war to be made. And if, like, they're propaganda films, guys. They're propaganda films.
All war movies made in the U.S. are propaganda films.
You want to know something that really pisses me off? I got really close to the mic for that. Sorry if it assaulted your ears a bit. So, here's a little tea on how the European, how European film works. So there are these things called, it's like called national cinema, okay? So you have like European national cinema, and then they have like world cinema. So national cinema is like movies, like I'm gonna use Poland. Movies made in Poland by Polish people for Polish people.
Okay.
There's no intent for it to go to another country. Now, that's not to say it might not, but this is not like Amelie. That's a French film, a French-German film, but it's a French film. That is not a national cinema piece. Okay. That was created specifically with the goal of becoming a world movie. Like, everyone in the world would see it.
Uh-huh.
But then they're like, Bicycle Thieves is an Italian film, an Italian neorealism film that became very famous. Not meant to become famous. That is an Italian national cinema piece.
Okay.
But it did become famous because a very good example of neorealism. And it's a good movie. So America doesn't really have that equivalent. Like, they don't teach about American national cinema because they quite literally are called national cinema. So those Polish films, Bicycle Thieves, those would be funded by the government. Like, the government would give money to the film industry and they would say, like, make films for this, about this, and the government would have a say in what goes into those movies. So that's a big criticism of national film from all around the world. A lot of people criticize national cinemas because, while it's good because the government is putting money into the arts, it's a way for the government to stimulate artistic economies, especially in, like, times of depression. It's also bad because it's a way of them censoring what gets out during, like, critical times, because national cinema really thrives whenever countries aren't doing very well, and they make, like, propaganda films. That's not to say, like, every national cinema piece is a propaganda film, because sometimes it does criticize the government. Mm-hmm. You'll just notice it never does it, like, too much.
Yeah.
But then people talk about, like, when I was in my national cinema, I was in a European national cinema class, which was about European national cinema in all the different European countries, and or some of them, the major ones, and we never really, like, talked about American film, obviously, because it was about European film, but also because, like, they said in the lecture, you know, America doesn't have this because everything that we do is privately funded. The government doesn't fund movies. They don't give money to movies. But that's not really true, because they just do it in this weird, underhanded way. Like, war films are our national films. Pretty much every war film is a national film. It is basically completely funded by the government, or at least mostly funded by the government. The government has a say in the script. They get to say how it's published. Like, those are basically the qualifications of national cinema.
It's wild.
But they sit, like, American, like, Hollywood sits on, like, this high horse of, like, we don't have national cinema. Like, everything we make is for everyone because we privately fund our films. But it's like, that's not even true!
No, the government funds all war movies.
I know, and a lot of people were like, I remember in my class, I ended up saying that because they're talking about how, like, why America doesn't have a national film, and it's because more capitalist than their countries. And then I was basically like, well, yeah, but then I told them about the war movies, and they were like, that's real? And I was like, yeah. And because it's not in the law, there's nothing to really hide it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
The thing about the national cinemas there is they can only really stop things up to a point because every citizen knows which films are paid for by the government.
Okay.
So they have to, like, disclose, like, this was paid for by the Polish national government. And then people can kind of make up their own minds about whether something is just propaganda.
Uh-huh.
Because it's like, okay, well, the government paid for it, clearly.
Yeah.
But because we aren't forced to disclose those things,
all war films are propaganda.
All war films are propaganda. Promise.
Promise, you guys. Listen, Unless it's
directly criticizing war, in which case either someone very rich produced it, Mm-hmm. Or there will, you'll notice there is little to no artillery.
Yeah, exactly. Like Blood Diamond, like no artillery. Yeah. I know that's about the diamond trade and everything, but also there's a lot of military, like, stuff that goes on in it. Like,
yeah, you'll notice that there's not a lot of, like, tanks and stuff.
Yeah.
Because where are you supposed to get those?
Yeah.
If you don't get them from the government.
It's crazy.
It's not like the government just sells those things once they're out of commission.
Yeah, it's... So, I'm just saying, if you're watching American Sniper, it's propaganda.
It's propaganda. That I remember when that film came out and people were like, best film ever. They were like,
creaming their pants over it.
Literally. And I was like, okay. not interested.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it's a fine film. It's Clint Eastwood. Sure. Like, it's pretty and, like, the acting's really good.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like a bad film, but it's propaganda.
Yeah. Why would I watch that when I could watch, like, what is that movie where the guy gets stuck with the rock 27 hours?
127 hours with James Franco?
Why would I watch anything? Why would I watch a war film when I could watch 127 hours?
So true.
It's as tense, it's as patriotic, and it makes me feel better.
Yeah.
And I don't have to watch little children die. I mean, I don't have to watch that in those movies either because we hide that, but that is what happens. I don't have to think about it.
They don't really hide in American Sniper.
Oh, that's good.
They kind of just, he just murders a little, I mean, he has a bomb. The little boy has a bomb, but I mean, I don't think that's an excuse to murder kids, but whatever.
Oh, but they gave him a bomb, though. They didn't talk about all the unbombed children, unarmed children that we kill.
Yeah.
Don't worry. We kill plenty of armed children as well, is what they said.
Don't worry.
Don't worry. Children are not safe here. We don't protect any kids. Oh, boy.
Okay, guys.
Sorry if you're pro-military. I mean, I'm pro-military to a point.
To an extent.
To an extent that...
We are way past.
Yeah. To an extent we passed a long time ago. Listen, people are like, the Founding Fathers, this is what they wanted. And I'm like, actually, a lot of the Founding Fathers argued for a long time on whether or not we should even have a standing military in peace times.
Also, all of those laws were made in the 1700s.
By white property-owning men.
So, maybe they're not the most reliable people.
Maybe not. By the same guys that, like, half of them were like, yeah, I don't really think this slavery thing fits into the Constitution. But then they were like, but we don't want the Southerners to be uncomfortable. Everyone from the North is like, yeah, these slaves are kind of right.
Yeah, like, I'm not really comfortable with this, but we don't want to make the South uncomfy.
Then I guess I'll just own 300 of them. And Thomas Jefferson...
At Thomas Jefferson?
I guess I'll just own 300 slaves and rape them. I mean, if it's gonna be legal. I mean, behind closed doors, I'll say, yeah, it shouldn't be legal.
But also... Like,
I'll definitely own 300 slaves.
And rape them.
And rape them. I'll definitely do that. To make the South not uncomfortable. So that the South won't secede. Yeah. I mean, they had some good things, but they had some bad things too, didn't they? Anyway.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening.
All right.
Bye.